Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Okay, great. So I'll just jump into it now. So my guest today is Ray E. Boomhauer, the author of Richard Tregaskis, Reporting Under Fire from Guadalcanal to Vietnam. Tregaskis covered the war from the Doolittle Raid to the Battle of Midway, Guadalcanal. He was on the Russell Islands. He was on bombers over the South Pacific. He then went to Sicily, where he was wounded in the head. Was at the Battle of Aachen, went back to the Pacific to fly in B-29s over Japan, and was on the USS Ticonderoga, where he flew along with some torpedo bombers. And then after the war, he traveled the world and reported in Korea and Vietnam, and did all this while suffering from diabetes. And he still managed to write 3 books during the war. But despite all this, he seems to have faded from memory to a certain degree. You being the author of a biography on Richard Tregaskis, I guess I would ask, what's your elevator pitch for Tregaskis, and why might he belong in the pantheon of war correspondents?
I would argue that Richard Tregaskis is considered by his contemporaries who covered World War II as one of the bravest of the brave war correspondents who experienced the conflict. And I think he ranks right up there with Ernie Pyle as a chronicler of the average man and what they went through during the war. And I would also argue that Tregaskis probably covered more territory than almost any other reporter who wrote about the war. You know, as you said, he started out in the Pacific, covered a variety of action there, went to the European theater, was there for the invasion of Sicily and the capture of that territory, then skipped over not far away to the mainland of Italy and was there for the invasion of that country. And it was there in Italy where he was covering action that a German shell finally found him and wounded him in the head, and he fought back and recovered and really could have rested on his laurels. And Ernie Pyle said that when he wrote a column about Tregaskis while Tregaskis was recovering from his wounds in Italy, that if he had experienced what he had done and had suffered such a wound, he would have gone home and sat in his lounge chair for the rest of the war. But Tregaskis felt a calling to go back to cover the conflict, was there for the breakout from the Normandy beachhead, followed the troops until the capture of Aachen, Germany, and it was brutal street fighting battle to capture that city, and finally had enough, went back home, and the editors at the Saturday Evening Post decided that he should go back and cover the action in the Pacific. And they even asked him, do you really want to go? And he said, not really, but I think I ought to go. And he did. And that's when he followed a crew of a B-29 Super Fortress bomber from their flight from America across the Pacific to Guam, and went with them on 5 bombing missions against Japan. And even after that was finished, went back and reported from the USS Ticonderoga went on a bombing mission on an Avenger bomber against a Japanese naval base. And it was a harrowing experience. And actually, the pilot and one of the crew members he flew with on a subsequent mission while he remained on the carrier, something happened to their plane. They spun in, hit the ocean, and were killed. So that happened to Tregaskis quite often during the war on Guadalcanal. And, of course, he came the closest to losing his life when he was wounded on Mount Cornell in Italy. So as you could probably tell from that list of battles he endured, he endured a lot during World War II and wrote very well about his experiences in three books, two nonfiction accounts, including the classic Guadalcanal diary, and also writing about his experiences in Sicily and Italy and his wounding in the book Invasion Diary. And then wrote from his experiences in Aachen a fictional account called Stronger Than Fear, which really, I think, captures very well what he experiences in the street fighting in Aachen through other characters that he invented based on real people. So it's quite a career and one that I thought should be written about. And I was also, you know, looking for kind of the completion of what I'm calling my war correspondent trilogy. I had written previously before about Ernie Pyle, who's from my home state of Indiana, someone I knew very well from my college experience at Indiana University, studying journalism, going to class at Ernie Pyle Hall, seeing his memorabilia displayed there. So it was quite an achievement for me to write a youth biography about his career from his days growing up in Dana all the way to his death on Okinawa in World War II. I followed that up by writing about a gentleman named Robert Sherrod, who was kind of considered the Ernie Pyle of the Marine Corps during World War II as he follows the Marines through the Central Pacific. So I wrote a book about his experiences in the Pacific. So Tregaskis, who I had known since I was a high school student, I remember reading Guadalcanal Diary, being very impressed by it. So he seemed like the perfect guy to complete my war correspondence trilogy. So I was able to do research on his life and able to write the book. It was published in November of 2021 by the University of New Mexico Press.
Okay, great. Thanks. Yeah. Actually, you got a little bit ahead of me there.
Okay.
That's a great summary of Tregaskis' career experiences during the Second World War. And I mean, to a certain extent, I think it even that sells it short a little bit because, even between all of those high points of action, I mean, he was in Australia, in Vanuatu, if I remember right, Hawaii, came back to the United States to go to Walter Reed. So even between those high points, I think there's a lot of color, but
you get a real sense of what it was like to cover the war from, you know, getting your accreditation all the way to, you know, being assigned to a combat assignment by military authorities.
Yeah. And I appreciated the parts, you know, kind of about the red tape and the bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. He was right. Determined to fight through to get the assignments he wanted. So you did give us a little bit of background already and how you got into the subject of covering Tregaskis through the other two war correspondents that you wrote about. But if you could just for a moment give us some more background on how you came to publish this book and your academic background.
Sure. For the last 35 years, I've worked at the Indiana Historical Society in Indianapolis, Indiana. I started out my career, though, as a reporter, like Pyle and like Sherrod and like Tregaskis, working for a couple of small-town Indiana daily newspapers before switching to history. And since 1999, I've been responsible as editor of the Indiana Historical Society's Popular History Magazine, traces of Indiana and Midwestern history. And I've also found time on the side to write a number of books, more than a dozen now, usually biographical in nature. As I said, I've written books about Pyle. I've also penned biographies of Hoosier astronaut Gus Grissom, Lew Wallace, famous as the author of Ben-Hur, and other figures from Indiana's past as well. But the last couple of years, I've kind of branched out and writing a lot about journalists, not only Robert Sherrard, but a guy named John Bartlow Martin, who was a freelance reporter and wrote extensively as a kind of a long-form writer for Saturday Evening Post. And that led me, of course, to Tregaskis. And really, I started looking at him about in 2017 as a logical next choice after writing about Robert Sherrard. And in looking at his life, I found that there were two repositories of papers about him, one at the Howard Gottlieb Archival Research Center at Boston University. And I went there in the fall of 2018. And another larger collection at the American Heritage Center at the University of Wyoming. And I went there in the summer of 2019 and, you know, found out a lot of great material about him, was able to have the University of New Mexico Press agree to publish the book. And they're really invaluable resources, the archival repositories, but also there are a lot of online newspaper sources these days because he worked for the International News Service. And it was kind of the poor third cousin to the other two wire service agencies at that time. You had kind of the Associated Press at the top, United Press in the middle, and the International News Service, which was part of the Hearst newspaper empire, was kind of third in line. They were kind of like, you know, the number three, and they tried harder than the other wire services, as where the AP could send out, you know, 10 men to cover a breaking major news story. The International News Service were lucky if they could get one guy out there to cover the news that was breaking at the time. And so his reporting from the war was featured in a lot of small-town newspapers throughout the country. So, of course, these days we have newspapers.com, which was a great resource for me in tracking down how well Tregaskis's writing about the war was filtered down to places all over the country. And I was able to get a lot of material out of, we got past the military censors and tried to inform the public about what was really going on in the war in the Pacific and then later on in the war in Europe as well. And at the end of the war, he kind of switched from the International News Service to writing for the Saturday Evening Post, and especially his time with the B-29 bomber crew. But also, after the war ended, writing about the occupation of Japan and the establishment of trying to a new government there, and also wrote a number of articles for the Saturday Evening Post about the return of veterans to their former lives as civilians, and wrote quite a good series profiling these veterans and how they were coping with their return to civilian life.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it definitely comes across in the book that Tregaskis had a real skill for communicating the experiences of individual soldiers or sailors or Marines. And, I mean, he was present in several fairly significant battles and covers those with a unique perspective. You know, in mm-hmm. my show, I am very much concerned with, you know, the operational or strategic level of war, but I do appreciate getting that very foxhole view of what was going on. What do you think gave him that his unique style of reporting or storytelling? I think in the book there's a quote that I appreciated fairly early where he says, "The closer he came to getting killed in his career, the better the story would be if he survived." But what would be your take on that?
I think that's a great quote to use, that he always tried to get it as close to the action as possible. He didn't. He and the other war correspondents I've written about didn't want to be seen as what were called communique commandos. That is, reporters who were more than happy to remain behind the battle lines back at headquarters and getting the canned handouts from public relations officers detailing the advances in the war. Tregaskis had to go out there and see for himself. And by doing so, of course, you're risking your life. You know, Pyle, in the end, you know, lost his life, got too close to the action on Ishima, the small island off the coast of Okinawa, and was killed. And Tregaskis, of course, came very close to losing his life as he got close to the action between German and American soldiers in Italy. He also had the knack for making connections with larger-than-life figures. When he was on the Hornet leading up to the Battle of Midway, he became friends with John Waldron, who was the commander of the doomed Torpedo Squadron 8 that took off to attack the Japanese fleet. And only one member of that squadron, Ensign George Gay, survived that battle. And on Guadalcanal, he became very close with Colonel Red Mike Edson and his Marine Raiders, accompanying them on missions against the Japanese, and being able to be there when after the battles of Edson's Ridge, also known as Bloody Ridge. And when he was in Aachen, he became close and got a lot of comfort because he was his nerves had almost, you know, his nerves were shot at the time. Yeah. Because of experiences in being wounded, kind of suffering a little bit of PTSD at the time, and it was getting to him. And an officer named Ozel Smoot kind of talked him down and offered some words of comfort to him during some very tough battles in the street fighting in Aachen, and got his nerves to finally to settle down. And he was able to report on the battle and get his reports back to the folks back home so they knew what was going on in the war.
Yeah, so you kind of touched on two points there that I wanted to dig into a little bit deeper. One was, so his story almost sounds like fiction with all the, all of the history-changing engagements and battles that he was present for, but also just the personalities that he met firsthand, some of whom you've mentioned already, Lieutenant Commander Waldron, Red Mike Edson. Seems he at least was in the same room as several high-ranking officers, including, you know, Admiral Gormley, General MacArthur, General Patton. How much do you think that informed his perspective, I guess you could say, having spent time not only in the trenches, literally, but also in the presence of those larger-than-life figures?
I think he didn't let the larger-than-life figures, you know, influence him unduly. I think he's more comfortable in dealing with the frontline troops and the officers behind the lines, kind of like what Pyle was in his coverage during World War II. They much preferred to be out there with the men, suffering as, you know, as best as they could, what they suffered, you know, eating the same food, experiencing the same conditions, and risking their lives in the process. As you mentioned before, he always tried to get as close to the action as possible because that's where the best stories were. And later during in the war, you know, he offered some tips to the folks back home, the best way to tell, you know, how accurate are these pieces we're getting back, these dispatches from the war zones. And he said you could always tell that because, you know, if a correspondent was talking about people in a company or a platoon, you knew very well that they were very close to the action because those were the people that are doing the actual fighting. And you could tell by the datelines and by the descriptions that a reporter was using. And Tregaskis always tried to get as close as he could to the front lines because he knew that's where the best stories would be.
And it certainly comes across in the biography as well. Some of the things I appreciate most are the stories, or not necessarily even stories, just accounts of life aboard ship when he's mm-hmm. when he's at sea, especially on the smaller destroyers. Just the strange level of discomfort, but mm-hmm. also having access to things like ice cream, which he makes clear is nearly unimaginable when you're with the Marines in Guadalcanal or with the right. With the army in Germany or in Sicily. And he does state that he does have a real appreciation for the average infantryman, but that there is a very similar sort of bravery or fortitude that goes with being, you know, a sailor on a destroyer or a part of a bomber crew. I think I actually, yeah, I copied it down here, one of the quotes from the book about that that contrast between the different role that different warfighters would have had. Mm-hmm. Let me find it here. It reads, the opposition's, this is from a bomber pilot who had fought in the both the Pacific and in Europe. And
right.
Speaking about the Pacific, he says, the opposition's much stiffer. Sorry, he's speaking about Europe and contrasting with the Pacific. So about the European theater, he states, the opposition's much stiffer all along the line than it was in the Pacific. Here, you go out to fight like hell for an hour and then come back and put on a dress coat for dinner. Down there in the Pacific, you lived war. When you got back to the field from a bombing mission, the Japs were always coming over, bombing and strafing. They didn't kid around. The food was a lot worse, and half the time we didn't have enough to eat. So that's the sort of color that I appreciate. Where would you say his, maybe his knack for communicating that came from, or was it just his personal experience of having been there in so many different capacities?
I think he was able to, get across his experiences to the average folk back home because of his long experience as a reporter. He had begun, writing for the public as early as his high school days when he earned a bit of extra money reporting on, sporting events and other activities at his local high school while he was growing up in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And he continued to do that when he went to Harvard, picking up some money to help him supplement his scholarships that he received for attending Harvard by writing for local Boston newspapers about Harvard events. So he had this vast experience to draw upon in writing about events and getting across, what was going on behind the scenes for newspaper readers. And he took that experience with him as he went overseas for the International News Service. And I was always impressed by the bravery he showed. He's a very tall correspondent. He's at least 6'5", according to his War Department ID card. But other people describe him later on as tall as 6'6", 6'7". And his friends joked with him as he went off to war that he would be an easy target. And actually, the Japanese might even capture him and use him as an observation post. So he had a lot going against him. He was tall, he was thin, and he was suffering from a very debilitating illness that he kept secret from his bosses, which he had learned before, Pearl Harbor, that he suffered from a family illness, diabetes, and so he didn't, although insulin was available at that time to control the disease, he didn't use it. He, after the war, he switched to an insulin regimen But he tried to control his disease by controlling the diet that he ate, which was difficult to do in a war zone. In fact, for his first assignment to cover the Doolittle raid, he took along with him 100 tins of sardines. And one of his fellow correspondents joked with him, you know, there's going to be food on these ships that we're going to be on, you know. But he always tried to keep his illness secret from everyone. It really, I couldn't find, really pinpoint the precise time that his secret got out. But I kind of go back to the article that Ernie Pyle wrote about him in his recovery after Tregaskis was wounded in Italy. And Pyle does mention that, you know, Tregaskis tried to tell the doctors, you know, that he suffered from diabetes because they had to know that before they operated on him. So I think he kind of broke the news about what Tregaskis was dealing with during his wartime reporting days.
Yeah, and I think obviously he was an incredibly driven individual. I mean, to go to a war zone with diabetes to keep it secret, I think by the time maybe that he was wounded and shared that information publicly, it, you know, he had kind of earned his stripes, as it were. So he had kind of had already gotten his way in there or into the profession. But,
yeah, and he was very meticulous in what he observed and what he reported. He carried along with him small notebooks in his pocket. He would fill them up and with information that he found out from his reporting, and then every night would take that material and put it into a black gilt-edged diary. And in that diary, you know, he summarized what happened during the day and tried to mark the key moments in his notebooks. And the theory was that he used for Guadalcanal diary later, that he could get all the details he needed by referring to his notebook numbers, and then he could write a book about his experiences from his notes. And this is something that he used all the way to his reporting days in Vietnam, although he tried to do a simpler system there where he just had one large diary book that he would enter the information in. And I particularly recall a conference about Guadalcanal where Richard Franks, who's one of the experts on the battle, someone asked him, you know, about Guadalcanal diary and how accurate it was. And Franks said that he was very delighted to see that the information that Tregaskis observed firsthand was always very accurate, and he was very detailed in what he wrote about, and it could be trusted that what he wrote in his book is what actually happened. And so I was always impressed by how accurate he was in the information he wrote about. This in spite of, you know, all the censorship that every reporter had to go through with the various military authorities, with the various military services during World War II, the Army, and particularly the Navy, which was the service that was probably the toughest when it came to censoring reporters.
Right. And it seems that he was just writing all the time, not only in the field, mm-hmm. but then when he would get any spare time that he had, whether he was in the hospital or on flights back across the Pacific or mm-hmm. just waiting to get to the next objective or the next assignment. Where do you think that drive might have come from in his childhood or in his college career?
I think it came from his experiences growing up. You know, he was always a very bright student as a young person. His mother, in a piece that she wrote about her two children, remember taking young Dick and his sister Madeline on numerous trips to nearby New York City, going to museums and other cultural institutions. So I think he had a very strong educational background that kind of fired his imagination in his thirst for, you know, learning about new things. And reporting offered him quite a variety of experiences, and he seized upon them as much as he could, writing not only about, the police, covered the police beat for Bossa newspapers. He wrote feature articles. He went out on spot news assignments. So he had that experience to draw upon when he went overseas. So when he was thrown into new experiences, whether it be, you know, going out on a mission on a ship, flying on a B-17 bomber, going out on a long-range mission with Marine raiders, or marching up down the hills with parachutists in Italy, he knew that he could cover whatever came his way, and he could tackle all these strange new experiences that were thrown at him.
Yeah, I think what comes through in the biography is that maybe there were three things that really were the keys to his success. One being his personable manner. Towards the end, you write about how his wife had mentioned that he could be essentially conducting an interview with a soldier, and they wouldn't even realize what was going on. They just thought he was being friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, his drive. I mean, obviously, he was incredibly driven, maybe even a workaholic, always overseas. Potentially that may have led to problems with his first marriage, but you know, he was always writing either as a war correspondent, and then it seems when he wasn't in the heat of the action while he was recovering, and like you mentioned, after the Battle of Aachen, he decided to write a work of fiction. But then finally, dedication. It wasn't just that he was a generally amiable person or that he had an extremely powerful work ethic, but that he was dedicated to the men who were actually serving on the front lines. Somewhere towards the end of the book, as he's back in the United States recovering, you quote him as saying, "Don't they know that boys are dying and being crippled and living in dirty, rain-soaked foxholes? Don't they know how close we came to having our cities bombed, our people killed, our children crippled and starved?" He lambasted civilians for complaining about food rationing, gasoline shortages, and crowded trains when their own flesh and blood are suffering the agonies of hell on their behalf.
He was always very dedicated to telling accurately the stories of the men doing the actual fighting, and that kind of lambasting of the out-of-touch civilians came at a time when he was recovering, you know, from his wounds that he received overseas, back home, and seeing all the, you know, people going out, having a good time, those who had worked in the war industries, who had a bit of money now, enjoying, you know, good food, good drink. And always in the back of his mind, he remembered, you know, the hell that, you know, the Marines experienced on Guadalcanal, the tough conditions on Sicily in the mountainous countryside there, as the American soldiers and their British Tommy allies were battling German soldiers in the hilly countryside there. And he just always wanted to remind people of the sacrifices being made by the soldiers, airmen, and sailors who were doing the fighting in the Pacific and in Europe as well.
Yeah. So that's everything specifically that I wanted to ask you about or bring up. Was there anything we didn't discuss that you think is important or pertinent, or just maybe an anecdote from researching his life that maybe didn't make it in the book that you still think is worth telling?
Well, there's always, when you're doing a biography, there are things that you wish you knew that you never found out. And that happened in this book on Tregaskis. Was in going through his papers, I came across some delightful letters between from him to his sister Madeline back home, you know, and talking about his experiences on Guadalcanal, the time he took to, you know, write his book, a famous book, Guadalcanal Diary, talking about maybe the financial windfall that might occur, and how he would help out his parents in, you know, buying a new used car for them or helping paying off their home. And very fun and enlightening letters that told a lot about his character. But unfortunately, there's really nothing that I found in his papers talking about what he thought of when his sister died, as she did during the war. And if you go through the newspapers of the time, it's pretty much she killed herself. She committed suicide by getting in her car and leaving it in the garage, leaving it running and dying. But I never found anything of him talking at the time or afterwards, after the war, about how the loss of his sister affected him. And, that's something that I wish I'd found out and that I wish I knew more about. But there's always these tantalizing questions sometimes when you're doing biographies, details that you wish you knew, but are sometimes, lost to time. Who knows, in years to come, someone might be scrounging through their attic and they might find, letters or other material that might shed some light on your subject that you wish you had at the time. But you have to do the best you can with the material you have, because, eventually you've got to stop your research, get down and get your fingers working and actually put words on paper or words on your computer screen these days and get the book done, because that's your ultimate goal as a biographer, to get the book done, get it out to the public so they know more about this individual that you've devoted sometimes years of your life to.
Yeah, definitely. Let them know. The aspect of eventually you just got to start writing, and there might still be questions, but you got to go with the best answer you have.
Yeah, right.
That's interesting though about the death of his sister. That was just him being a product of his times. That wasn't something that people talked about.
Yes, something you talked about. Yeah, it's just too painful, and suicide was still seen as a bit of a scandal at that time, and so it was something he just didn't want to tackle and or put on paper.
Okay. Was there anything else you wanted to bring up?
I could say something that, Tregaskis, after World War II, of course, continued to go back to combat and eventually ended up in Vietnam, where he tried to, kind of resurrect the popularity he had experienced with his book, Guadalcanal Diary. And, as he did in World War II, connected again with the soldiers who had gone to Vietnam in the early days of our experience there. These weren't the draftees of the later time in the war that we think about today in the later 60s. These were all mainly volunteers, and they were veteran soldiers, experienced, and very dedicated to their craft. Tregaskis had some conflict with some of the younger reporters who had not had the experience he had in wartime, who were covering the war for the American media at that time, including a reporter for the New York Times named David Halberstam. And there's a very poignant story that Halberstam tells about, he saw Tregaskis as one of his heroes, read his stuff from World War II and had been more than happy to take Tregaskis with him to talk to the sources he had developed during his reporting for the Times. And they were coming back from one of these trips, and Tregaskis turned to him and said, if I was doing what you're doing, I'd be ashamed of myself, because he thought that he hadn't, Halberstam had not fully committed to supporting the American war effort in Vietnam. And it just shows the differences between that World War II generation and the new breed of journalists in Vietnam. that were more willing, I think, to question the government. Of course, it was a different war.
Right.
You know, it was a war that followed. There was no front line, action and killing and combat could occur while you were sitting having a coffee on the streets of Saigon. You know, a VC bomber or suicide bomber come by and throw a grenade and kill soldiers who were not in uniform but were, you know, in civilian clothes trying to enjoy themselves.
Right.
And this conflict kind of led to my next project. Tregaskis had written a review of Halbert Sim's book about the war. And he kind of lambasted Halbert Sim and his view of the conflict. But they had good words to say for another young reporter who was in Saigon at the time, a gentleman named Malcolm Brown, who wrote for the Associated Press, who had written his own book called The New Face of War. And Tregaskis had recommended that book if people wanted to know more about what was going on in South Vietnam at that time in the early 1960s. So that led me to think, well, here's a guy I've got to know more about, Malcolm Brown. And so that led to my next book project, which is now to be published by the University of New Mexico Press in early 2024, which is a biography of Malcolm Brown, really diving into his experiences in Vietnam from reporting as a Saigon bureau chief in the early 1960s all the way to the fall of Saigon in 1975. You know, he was there in the country letting the folks back home know what about our experiences in Vietnam. And so it's a book that takes a look at how different that war was and how it changed America, and particularly a photo that he took that became one of the iconic images of the war. If you think about Vietnam, you usually think of three photographs that kind of tells the story of the war. You have the one from the Tet Offensive, when you have a South Vietnamese police chief shooting a suspected Viet Cong guerrilla in the head following the Tet Offensive. You have the shot of the young Vietnamese girl screaming, running down the road naked following a napalm attack on her village. And very early in the war, a photograph that set the scene for a lot of what Americans thought about the conflict was one taken by Brown, and it was in 1963. It was a Buddhist protest against the Xiêm government, and it was a Buddhist monk who sets himself on fire and gives his life for the Buddhist cause. And that photograph, which has appeared on front pages of newspapers across the country, was taken by Brown, and he was the only Western newsman able to capture that event on film and get it back to AP member newspapers across the country and across the world as well. So that's going to be my next book project.
I mean, yeah, it sounds fascinating and definitely like a change of pace from writing about Tregaskis, who, I mean, like I said, maybe was a product of his time where he was very suited to writing about World War II, but when he got to Vietnam, maybe it was the nature of the war, maybe the way he had learned to write about war. At least the impression he got is that it was time for maybe a new generation of a war correspondent with a different outlook to cover that war, it being so different from the Second World War.
Exactly.
Okay, well, again, today my guest was Ray Boomhauer. Thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Sean, thank you for the opportunity.
Great. Hey, okay, and then I'll edit this part off. I just like to do the canned, you know, sign off.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that went well. Hopefully, we covered everything you wanted to talk about. I really enjoyed the book. I'm glad I got the chance to read it. It seems like I say this every time I talk to an author, you know, I feel like I've read a lot about the Second World War. You know, maybe not an expert, but a well-informed amateur. And even there's always things I'm coming across that I hadn't heard of before, you know, like
everything. Yeah, it's amazing.
In this
yeah.
book I've read about before, I'm familiar with, but I've never heard. I can't believe I've probably run across the name Richard Tregaskis, but it just, you know, was just another data point that didn't get filed away.
Right. But, yeah,
definitely the way you wrote about it and the, I guess that I mentioned it a few times, that kind of foxhole look, I really appreciated to see these events that I've written about from that perspective.
It's a, yeah, different perspective is always helpful whenever you're, you know, dealing with these large scale events like, you know, a world war. So it's always helpful to get to kind of focus down on what the actual men in the trenches, so to speak, we're dealing with. Yeah.
And also it kind of reminded, I was started thinking about, I don't know if you've ever read the Flashman papers. It's a fiction by George MacDonald Fraser. He wrote them in like from the 70s to the early 90s.
I remember them, but I'd never read them, but I remember, you know, seeing them, you know, kind of written about. And,
I've got all of them on my bookshelf over here. I've read all but the last one. It kind of reminded me of that because Flashman, he's a Victorian era scoundrel, but he's in all these different, he's in like the retreat from Kabul and in the Taiping Rebellion and all these, he's ends up in like involved in the Zulu War, just like every major conflict of the 19th century. And he meets all the famous people, Abraham Lincoln, Queen Victoria, Bismarck. And it kind of reminded me of that. I was like, how did this guy find himself in every single major event of World War II and running into not all of, but a lot of the major characters of the war?
Yeah, it's just amazing to me. I didn't know, and I'd read Guadalcanal Diary, but and not knowing a lot about his life, but his, you know, his first mission, he sent off, you know, to cover the famous Doolittle raid. So that's quite an event to cover for your first assignment in the war.
Definitely an auspicious start.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, hey, thanks again. I'll send you and Michael an email once it's up with the link and everything.
That sounds good. Okay, thank you, Sean.
Thanks
all
for
right.
your time.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.